This is an ABC podcast.
Kia ora, koutou katoa, and good fellow morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. We're proud to bring you our show from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Well, guess what? There's a lot to get through today with so much happening out in the region, with polluted lagoons in Vanuatu and US deportees in the Marshall Islands are reportedly responsible for the increase in violent crimes. And get ready for a mashup you may not have thought of. Yes, K-pop and polis equals K-pop. Polly's. More on those stories shortly. Remember, we are across Facebook and Instagram at ABC Pacific. Feel free to like and follow us there. But I'm Aggie Tupou, and this is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We begin in Vanuatu, where villagers living beside Erekoa Lagoon near Port Vila are planning to take the government to court for environmental neglect. They can't swim or fish in the lagoon because it's been heavily polluted by untreated sewage. The villagers have been trying themselves to restore the waters to their former health, but say the government needs to keep its promises and play its part. Leah Lowenbu has the story.
The once turquoise waters of Erekoa Lagoon are now grey. People used to swim and fish there, but that's been banned because the water is highly contaminated with harmful bacteria. One of the chiefs of Erekoa village, Ken Andrew, says his community has been trying to restore its beauty, but it's too big a job.
Little organizations that we're setting up, we still continue to pick up all these plastic bags and all this to clean up the lagoon, but we got no power. We have not enough power because we are cleaning, but they're still polluting people. They're polluting the lagoon.
The biggest source of pollution comes from the nearby Port Vila Central Hospital. Its sewage flows directly into Erekoa Lagoon untreated.
The worstest one is the hospital. We already make investigations and all those, and we find out that when you press the flush toilet and the dirty plugs and all those stuffs inside the sink, direct to the lagoon. There's no more way to stop.
Chief Kalmara Kalo's community lives next to where the hospital's sewage discharges into the lagoon. He remembers when people used to go fishing in the lagoon.
People who don't have a job use the lagoon to earn money, but with the pollution, they no longer can do that. But if the government takes action to stop this pollution, the lagoon will be clean again and people can start earning their living.
He too wants to see it cleaned up.
If we block the sewage drainage system of businesses close to the lagoon and the hospital, I believe the lagoon will return to how it was in the past. We would be able to eat shells and fishes.
Locals like Willie Silverio are trying to restore the lagoon's health by collecting rubbish in the lagoon and planting mangroves.
The Bridge Youth Association is put all his effort to make a change, to show to people that we have to consider this lagoon as a resourceful water or lagoon where the people live near. What Erekoa Bridge Youth Association is doing is very important to the community because they see that what we are doing is for the future generation.
But it's not enough. Now they're considering legal action. Chief Andrew says they've been asking the government to enforce existing environmental laws, but nothing's happened. Now they're getting legal advice to take court actions of their own.
Yes, we are thinking enough to blame the government into court because the hospital belongs to the government. And who can help us? There's nobody thinking that I will help you people to put the government out there. There's no one willing to come down like people that they have the big brains and all those to help people down there, the grassroots level. We need to fight these very slowly. We need to find funding somewhere to buy the lawyers and all those stuff.
The Director General of the Ministry of Health, Mr. Samuel Posikai Tapo, told Pacific Beat that construction company Grama Osinko has been contracted to fix the hospital sewage system. The government has allocated $350,000 for the work and it should be completed this year. Mr. Tapo said the ministry is looking for an additional $550,000 to transform the sewage system into a treatment plant. Villagers of Erakor Lagoon have been voicing their concerns since 2015 for the repairs, according to Chief Andrew. He's worried the government's announcement of repairs will turn out to be another false promise.
Since 2019, we've been sending some letters and some emails and through the Environment Department and to the Health Department of Health and all those. And they say, yeah, now they're sitting, they have sitting meetings and they're talking about and they're going to do it, but never things have done.
And that is Chief Ken Andrew from Erakor Village, ending Leia Lowenboo's story there. The offshore refugee detention centre on Nauru was empty mid last year, but a recent spate of boat arrivals in the last 6 months has again filled its confines. 64 people that arrived by boat are now caught up in offshore processing on the remote Pacific island for an indeterminate period of time. Asylum seeker advocates say they're raising all too familiar concerns about the conditions in the facility and the deteriorating mental health. This report from John Daly and Erin Park.
Though emptied last year, the asylum seeker detention facility at Nauru was never shut down. Now a new cohort of detainees are there, and they're traumatised, distressed, and being denied access to human rights information, asylum seeker advocates warn.
I think the Australian government absolutely needs to take responsibility for this practice, and it's something that is causing the men a great level of anguish and distress. And it's unnecessarily cruel.
Heidi Abdel-Ralph leads detention casework at the Asylum Seeker Resource Centre. Four boat arrivals in the last 6 months have repopulated the controversial facility at Nauru, a remote island thousands of kilometres northeast of Australia. 64 men from countries like China, Pakistan, India and Bangladesh now face isolation and deteriorating mental health, similar to previous detainees.
They are experiencing high levels of distress, anxiety, depression, sleeping issues, isolation, and some are expressing suicidal feelings.
She says that mental anguish is exacerbated by the absence of adequate trauma counselling support at the facility. Some of the men have told caseworkers their smartphones have been confiscated and replaced with basic phones, unable to make calls to Australia or abroad.
This is particularly distressing to them as they have been denied access to apps like WhatsApp to message and to video conference loved ones. They've also reported that shared computers have restricted access to certain websites such as the ASRC and human rights organisations.
Heidi Abdel-Ralph says detainees remain in the dark about how long they will be detained or how long it will take to have their claims of asylum processed.
Given the deterioration of people's mental and physical health every day that they're held offshore, Labor really needs to front up about their plans for these men and the latest group of arrivals and how long they're going to keep them trapped on Nauru.
In a statement to the ABC, an Immigration Department spokesperson said the government of Nauru is responsible for regional processing arrangements in Nauru, including accommodation and welfare. The spokesperson said individuals transferred to Nauru are provided with a mobile phone and have access to the internet and are treated with respect and dignity in accordance with human rights. Abul Rizvi is the former Deputy Secretary of the Australian Immigration Department and an immigration policy expert. He says the spate of boat arrivals isn't a result of surging activity of people smugglers, but rather a drop in aerial and maritime surveillance by Operation Sovereign Borders.
That seems to reflect not a funding problem, because they've got more funding than they've ever had. It appears to reflect a shortage of airworthy aeroplanes and a shortage of pilots.
Those challenges were acknowledged publicly by Australian Border Force Commissioner Michael Outram late last year. Mr Rizvi says offshore detention and third country resettlement policies for asylum seekers arriving by boat are very unlikely to change.
I think access for these people by UN agencies, access for these people by asylum seeker support people is entirely appropriate, and I think that should be allowed. But I very much suspect policy, overall policy in respect of these people will not change.
The Immigration Department says the government's policy response remains consistent. Unauthorised maritime arrivals will not settle in Australia.
And that's John Daly and Erin Park with that report.
Want all the latest Pacific news, sports and entertainment delivered in your inbox every Thursday? ABC Pacific have launched a free weekly newsletter with exclusive content from across the Pacific by your favourite ABC presenters. Be the first to know about upcoming events and competitions in your area, plus much more, absolutely free and direct to you. It's easy to sign up. Just go to abc.net.au/Pacific and enter your email to join today.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aggie Thupol. You may remember back in January the story of two Tongan male remains that were stored in the Australian Museum's collection in Sydney were repatriated to their home of Ewa Island in the south of Tonga. Now the museum is under pressure to recognise the same process be done for a collection of Vanuatu human remains. Someone who is a passionate advocate on this matter is President and co-founder of the Australian South Sea Islanders, Port Jackson, Imelda Davis. She spoke to me earlier that sensitive and meaningful consultations are needed when dealing with Vanuatu customary practices. There's history that comes with those remains. What also comes with that is the cultural significance in regards to how we treat, you know, our ancestors' remains. I'm wondering, what has been your advice or consultation around this?
Very frustrating, that's what it's been. So one of the challenges is people assume just because we're all Pacific descent, they don't take into account the Melanesian, the Polynesian, the Micronesian. So it's like, oh, tick, we've got a Pacific Islander who can look after these collections, and you really need to consider the cultural appropriation and the customary practice that comes with looking after those items, the lived experience and the respectful, I guess, consultation process that needs to happen. Even if you are that Sitika person looking after the items, you need to think about, okay, so is this men's business? Is it women's business? How were these items taken? And what are the rituals that were attached to those items? And should I really be in this space, or do I consult with, like I keep saying, the heads of mission who actually sit in this country, in Canberra, representing their nationals or they're deceased? And what's occurred here with Australia is that we have deceased remains sitting in a vault, and we have representatives from government of those countries sitting in Canberra. We have representatives in their island states that are the direct descendants of those remains that should be spoken to before anything else as a cultural protocol. We all bang on about cultural protocol and respect the mana, the this, the that, but it's all very superficial a lot of the times, where people look at using it as a vehicle to convince. But when you actually put it into practice, so whatever that means in terms of the direction from those executives that are running these institutions, there needs to be equal representation and respectful representation. And it's a cultural framework that we need to be looking at. Our parliament represents our people of Australia. You have 1,001 politicians. So why can't we create these models for things of great significance that matter to us and to the people of this nation, as well as those island states that have been affected drastically by this?
Have you actually, Wasikam, been aware of any dialogue then between the state and the federal government on these remains?
So the dialogue has been whatever I've sent out as a part of my lived experience and my advocacy, working with the heads of mission in Canberra, working with the Vanuatu government, and as a recognised chairperson and, I guess, organisation by those governments in leading issues on Ngāi Vanuatu in Australia. When it comes to institutions, I guess those colonial institutions that are funded heavily to look after our people that are in those vaults or in those bunkers in Western Sydney. And it has been raised with me that Western Sydney University is believed, this may be hearsay, to be receiving our relics, our ancestral relics that have been taken from the Australian Museum here in the city where they're intended to rest initially when those collections were founded. Where's the stakeholder consultation around that for us as taxpayers, ratepayers, and constituents of this local area that have trusted and supported the good intention of looking after those relics right here in the city of Sydney, the funder of the Australian Museum in particular, MacDoc Foundation, who are responsible for their tag is building community resilience for people and the planet. So where is that happening for our constituents and how can we attest this work is really happening? And having sensitive conversations with government around the repatriation or the maintenance and well-being of those ancestral relics.
Are we in a place where the museum has actually admitted that these remains do need to be returned to their rightful owners?
In relation to the Australian Museum in particular, I know that they have done some repatriation earlier on, it was in the 80s, on the brink of recognition for Vanuatu or independence. I'm not an expert in this work. I'm just merely someone who's passionate, as I said, about the human rights and advocacy for all things that relate to our peoples. So the repatriation process, I think, would be incredibly complex from discussions that I've had in the past because of, I guess, museums wanting to know, you know, how are these things going to be housed? Do you have the capacity in the islands to look after these relics and these human remains? But, you know, the conversation has to be a serious conversation with these island states about how they see fit or feel about receiving these items or if not, or do they want to just bury them? So there's rituals that are attached to all of that. But again, it comes back to the cultural appropriate ways of doing things and consulting with the right people.
Respectfully then, do we not have the appropriate people to go to have to try and address and even help to give consultation about things like this, about these remains?
No, we have the appropriate people. They're being bypassed. People who've got lived experience, customary practice, men in particular, because it's men's business, is getting confused with all this political nuance around, I guess, culturally inappropriate ways of doing things for Indigenous people, if I can put it diplomatically. And when you're working with ancestral relics and spirituality, there's consequences that come with that. So whatever that looks like down the track, we don't know. But at the same time, let's get back. If we're talking about empowering the people and giving back and identifying with those practices, then why aren't we doing that? Why are we being superficial about it? You've got a Vanuatu Cultural Centre, for God's sake. There's 4,000 relics in the Australian Museum that belong to our people. And why are these conversations still happening when we've got all this recognition and political goodwill? Because it's a money-making situation.
There's also unmarked graves across Australia that like include nearly 60,000 Melanesians. What's the work that's been done around that, though?
We've had a memorial site since the 70s in recognition of the 60,000 that died, but also the unmarked graves that exist in their local communities. This is for the people, by the people, in recognition of their people, but the government's still sitting there. I mean, there's no real commitment, but, you know, there needs to be an affirmative action plan that's going to work for the nation. My grandfather, my mother's father, was 12 years old when he was stolen off Vanuatu. My great-great-grandmother was 14 years old. There's a lot to be answered for, but it's like we're Australia's dirty little secret. But we're talking about Pacific Step Up and our neighbours and our families, and we're donating, you know, warships to countries. Fix the infrastructure, mate, for these communities and allow them to take back what's theirs. We are working with the Vanuatu government to hopefully get strong representation. Everyone needs to get involved in whatever way, shape or form, because that's the only way that the governments are really going to step up and take notice. But we've had people power for a long time. But the real change comes within governments and policy and program.
And that is President and co-founder of the Australian South Sea Islanders Port Jackson, Waskam Imelda Davis. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Well, there's concerns in the Marshall Islands that criminal deportees from the United States are behind a spate of recent violent crimes. The Marshall Islands Journal reports the mayor of the capital, Majuro Lejek, saying the impact of deportees on his community has been nothing short of devastating. He's calling on the government to urgently step in to protect the capital, citing in a letter to President Hilda Heine four incidents of violent assaults committed by deportees, with two that just occurred last month. For more on this, I'm joined now by the editor of the Marshall Islands Journal, Giff Johnson, who's been covering this story. With that, I say welcome, Giff.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. Why has this become an issue in recent weeks?
This has really been an ongoing situation for quite a while, and I'd say the biggest problem in the matter of people being deported from the United States is that the Marshall Islands has simply never had any kind of a system for dealing with it. And, you know, you get people who are deported and they don't, you know, they just come here. They may have never really lived here. Maybe they moved to the U.S. with their family when they were little kids. They're not really connected with people here. Maybe they don't even speak the local language because they've been in the U.S. for a long time. Or some are recent, you know, left when they were adults and went to the U.S. and then got deported. But there's this whole range of problem situations, including that quite a number are convicted of violent crimes. And the Marshall Islands really doesn't have the layers of support that people in this situation need and that you would find in places like Australia or the U.S. So it's just kind of coming to a head. I mean, we've had a murder, a rape, a knife assault. You know, all of these have gone to court and people have been convicted. And then this last month, a couple of serious assaults out in this rural community. And that's what's got the Mayor Laddie Jack, you know, in an uproar about, because, you know, like, it's not getting better. And so the one good thing in this is that President Heine, since she came into office in January, she pretty immediately established a task force on deportations. And they just had their first meeting yesterday. And I think people are hopeful that will help to begin to influence some action from this side as to how to receive people who are being deported from the U.S.
Yeah, it seems quite significant, these deportations from the U.S. I'm wondering, do you think this is a long-standing arrangement?
Oh, yeah. I mean, so since 2013, that, say, 11 years, 236 people have been deported from the United States, and that includes 2 years of COVID. Border shutdown when there were no deportations. So, you know, basically we're looking at close to 30, an average of 30 a year. And if you go back to the beginning of the second Compact of Free Association back in 2004, it's closer to like 350 people have been deported. And with the number of Marshallese migrating to the U.S., just like Micronesians, Marshallese, because they have visa-free access to America, I mean, the deportations are only going to increase just based on the numbers.
But, of course, the mayor, Majuro, has appealed for the government to intervene. I'm wondering, many citizens are probably thinking, is there any way to maybe stop the U.S. deporting these people?
Well, of course, you know, the U.S. and the Marshall Islands have a very close relationship, and so the Marshall Islands just accepts the people being deported without question. And as I said, there's been no system here, despite the fact that the doctor who runs the mental health program here at the Ministry of Health has been calling for years to get a system set up where he's involved, and, you know, the counselors and people are like involved in the repatriation of the folks coming back from America, and just to no avail. Like, you know, people just ignored it. But now we're seeing, you know, the results of a situation being ignored, where, you know, there's a lot of violent crime happening now involving involving people who've been deported. And, you know, there are many reasons for it, maybe, but it, like, it needs to be addressed. Now, I mean, I think that the Marshall Islands should engage with the U.S. to initially hold up on deportations involving serious assault crimes, murder, rapes, and like gun violent crimes. And the reason for this is that we have no system for engaging and dealing with folks who come in who have this background, right? So it's like somehow we have to find a way to a middle ground. I mean, the United States or Australia, I mean, they have systems where people come out of prison and there are, you know, job programs, there's counseling, there's probation officers. I mean, there's nothing like that here really as a system for folks who are in this type of a situation. So, yeah, it definitely needs a discussion with the United States, like serious discussion from this side, and it needs the domestic side to get organized on, you know, how to manage it.
Mm. I'm thinking about other support measures, though, Giff. Would increasing security in the capital be helpful?
Well, you know, I mean, we have an active local police department. We have a national police department. But, you know, we had a murder a couple years ago. One guy who had been deported murdered another guy who had been deported, and with a gun, right? And like in theory, guns are banned in the Marshall Islands. It's supposed to be very difficult to have guns. But the fact that a guy could, you know, a guy who was deported had a gun, it tells you that, like, the situation has risen to a different level. And quite frankly, I mean, the police force here, they don't carry guns. And thankfully so. But they're not primed up to deal with this level of violence. I mean, it's just a fact. So I don't really know how, you know, stepped up law enforcement, yeah, I mean, could have some impact. But, you know, I mean, this, what you're saying is needs to be part of the conversation with the different players in the Marshall Islands government and like NGO community who provide services to the community. I mean, everything should be on the table, and whether beefed up law enforcement is needed to, you know, with a special team that addresses people with violent histories coming back. Well, maybe that's a need. And like, this isn't unique to Marshall Islands. I've been reading some reports about Polynesia, like Tonga, Samoa, that have large numbers of deportations from Australia or New Zealand. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's generally a problem in these small island communities when you inject a few folks who have like drug and violent and, you know, these kind of violent past, and that's their experience, and they bring that into a tiny Pacific Island community. Wow, that's a tough situation for everybody.
Definitely. Well, Gopher, let's hope that something does get implemented for the safety, of course, the people there in the Marshall Islands. But we do appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you.
No worries. That, of course, is editor of the Marshall Islands Journal, Giff Johnson, here on Pacific Beat.
Are you wanting to break your betel nut addiction, zumba your way to a fitter you, or get on top of that excruciating case of gout? Pacific Pulse on ABC Radio Australia has you covered. Pacific Pulse seeks out experts, movers and shakers, and aunties and uncles from across our region to bust open our health issues, challenge taboos, and separate fact from fiction. Join host Melissa Macon on Pacific Pulse Wednesday at 6 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, let's switch our attention to Papua New Guinea, where the government has approved for a military and police operation to be carried out at the Pogeta gold mine in the country's highlands. The mine just reopened this year after several years of negotiations between the mine operator and the government, who were seeking a larger stake. The government now owns 51% of the mine. But in recent months, hundreds of illegal miners have been going into the site, and the government wants them removed. So, to understand the situation better, we are joined this morning by our PNG reporter, Belinda Cora. With that, I say hello, awesome, wanam.
Good morning, Leoana.
Thank you, Belinda, for joining us. This is very much a serious situation. Could you just sort of take us, though, through the background? Like, why is the mine so important?
Yes, very true. The Pogera gold mine is situated in Papua New Guinea's province of Enga, and it's operated for decades, extracting valuable resources and playing a huge role in the country's economy. However, in 2020, the government refused or declined the renewal of the mining lease held by the joint venture operator, and the decline actually forced the mine to close, and it also led to significant ramifications for the region's economy and affect employment and revenues as well. When it comes to revenue for government spending, Pogera Gold Mine contributes a tenth of PNG's annual export revenues. This in itself, apart from stakeholder benefits, makes it a very vital operating mine in Papua New Guinea. The mine actually reopened into 2023 after negotiations, of which the government landowners in the Angan provincial government now own a 51% stake in this mining project. So that's been a vital assurance for the government and landowners, especially the provincial government.
And when we look at the security issues at the mine, the government and police say that they're concerned about this. What's the concern?
The security issues surrounding the mine has been on top of the agenda for many years, following its closure right through to negotiations and to its reopening again in late 2023. The issues stems from the back of basic services, or the lack of it, into the area, the closure itself, the law and order issues following the lack of policing in the area, the influx of squatters from other provinces going into Enga, and more recently, again, illegal miners. And this security threat was further elaborated when Prime Minister James Marape announced Cabinet's decision to authorize a joint military and police operations. He said the actions comes in response to recent surge of unauthorized miners invading the special mining lease, or SML, areas, posing significant risks to both the trespassers and the official mine workers itself. Even the police commissioner of Papua New Guinea, David Manning, had issued a statement for a 48-hour notice on the 4th of this month for all illegal squatters to leave Pogera Valley. He said the illegal squatters have no connection with the land they have been occupying and had exploited the previous closure of the mine to illegally damaging properties, committing criminal offences and threatening peace and good order across the Pogera Valley.
So, Belinda, have the police actually arrived?
A very good question. We have not been able to receive any official confirmation for the arrival of this joint task force in Pogera itself, and if they are on ground at this stage. However, we did manage to speak with the Pogera Police Station Commander, Chief Inspector Martin Kelly, on what the general situation is on ground in Pogera. So we'll just listen to a quick grab following this interview.
The illegal mining problem has existed for the last 10 years since Place at Home. So there's no easy way out to address the situation. People just go into there, they get 30,000, 40,000 worth of gold, and that's so much money in their lifetime. So they're continuously going back in. Even though they are arrested, the maximum penalty from the court, maybe 2-3 years, they go back, spend the time in prison, come back, they're back in the pit. It's just a... The company and government has to have a solution. The solution they were proposing and they were talking about was relocation of landowners, but they never did that. So we still have a problem of illegal miners there.
Very interesting, Belinda. So what are the landowners saying about this issue then?
Yes, I managed to speak to some of the landowners in the area for the Pogara Valley, and at this stage they want peace to prevail in the valley again in Pogara. They want to be finally resettled with proper identification cards as genuine landowners, and they feel this can happen if increased security presence is in the valley. And at this stage they're wanting more communication, more open communication and dialogue with the provincial government and the government. And they want the removal of illegal squatters and the illegal miners in the area. So that's basically what I have been able to get from the landowners of Pogara at this stage.
Well, we will stay in touch, Belinda, in regards to this, because I'm sure it's going to be a bit of an ongoing issue. But we just want to say thank you to Mas for joining us this morning.
No worries. Thank you very much for having me.
Appreciate it, Belinda. That is our PNG reporter, Belinda Cora.
K-pop to me means more than just listening to music. It's learning to be myself.
I would say it's very new for Pacific males to partake in K-pop. No, there's still that stigma.
When you start dressing, looking different, everyone side-eyes you and they're like, don't try to stand out too much. But in K-pop, they're just like, no, like, celebrate yourself.
In case you don't belong to Generation Z, you might be asking the question, what is K-pop? Well, it's an acronym short for Korean popular music. It's upbeat, colourful, and its impact has spread far beyond Asia. So much so that Pasifika youth are starting to adopt the trend. Now, that's the story behind a new mini-documentary titled K-Pollies. It's directed by Litia Tuipurilevo, and she joins us on the line this morning. Bula Litia.
Bola, how are you?
I am good. Thank you very much for joining us. Firstly, I must say, the last time we did speak was in regards to another series that you did, which was Still Here. So it's great to see the continuation of sort of stories that you were covering. How did you come by this unique idea for a film?
I guess following from Still Here, my interest has always been in contemporary Pacific storytelling and finding stories that are a little bit unexpected or surprising for audiences. And I was actually in Fiji at the time in 2022. And when I was there, Fiji was actually hosting its K-pop festival in Suva, which was quite a big thing over there. And I was like, this is really interesting. And then I just kind of realized actually my brothers, our older brothers in Fiji had been interested in Korean and Japanese pop culture since the early 2000s. And I had heaps of friends back in Aotearoa, Pacific friends, who were big K-pop fans, watched K-dramas, listened to the music. And I kind of put two and two together. And I was like, actually, looking at what's around me and what my friends are into, there's actually a really interesting story here about the popularity of K-pop within Pacific youth and Pacific audiences.
Oh, look, let me tell you, my daughter herself is very much a massive fan around K-dramas and K-pop. And, you know, this film centres around three Pasifika young people. You've got Boba, Ethan and Ashley. Why did you decide to centre the film around them?
I wanted to explore, sort of generally, like how K-pop is the relationship between Pacific youth. And I think I felt like I couldn't just do that with one person. But in the time frame that we had, which was around 20 minutes, I obviously couldn't do heaps and heaps and heaps of people as well. So I decided we did a call out and we got a lot of responses back. And I felt that these three had really interesting and different stories to share, but it all centered around their really personal and emotional connection to K-pop and how that sort of helps their sense of identity, self-expression, and all of that. So I felt that they had really strong voices that could speak to the sort of different generations of Pacific youth that have been interested in K-pop, Ashley being someone who's been into it since, you know, the early 2000s, with Boba and Ethan being sort of Gen Z and have come to it, I guess, and more recently in the last sort of 10 years.
Yeah, as you say, the film does talk about the difficulty of self-expression. Specifically, we know that that's something that a lot of kids, or even ourselves, a generation before, deal with within our Pacific culture. What kinds of difficulties did these kids face, though?
Boba sort of anchors the whole documentary, and they really speak to how when they got interested in K-pop in high school, they were bullied for it, they were teased, but also that they've struggled to, I think, sort of marry the sort of traditional ways sometimes that are put on young people about how to be a young Pacific person, how to be Tongan, and what you should be interested in and what you should be doing, and then their very deep passion and interest in K-pop. And I think some of the challenges are just around sometimes those expectations with tradition butting up against sort of contemporary or more contemporary ideas about how the young people want to express themselves, their gender identity, their sexual identity, what they wear and how they look. But I think what's been really beautiful with Boba's journey, Ethan's journey, and Ashley's journey is that through K-pop, they've been able to foster that sense of community, that sense of connection and support to express themselves authentically.
That's beautiful. If you've just joined us, we are speaking about a new mini documentary titled K-Pollies. It's been directed by Letia Tuipure-Levu, who is joining us this morning to speak about the influence of K-pop within our Pacifica community. So what is it about the K-pop genre you think, though, that gives them that sense of self-expression?
I think there's a few things. I mean, just looking at any K-pop music video with any of the K-pop idols or even the dramas, they're very bright, they're very fun. There's a sense of escapism, like it's this whole world that is completely unlike, I think, what we see back home. So there's this really beautiful way, I think, that you can escape into it. But I also think that there's a real fandom and a community that once you sort of get into it, you end up connecting with a whole lot of people, whether that's online, but also in person, whether it's through like some of the dance groups, the fan meetups, the activities, the concerts. There's sort of this whole web and this infrastructure that I think allows people to come in and make friends and have a really beautiful sense of like a support system around them, and everyone's very encouraging, it's very positive, it's very warm. And I think just it offers a space for people, and what we saw with particularly young Pacific people, a place to celebrate joy and just to be happy and to be themselves and maybe forget some of the troubles, you know, in their life, school, work, family, whatever, and just sort of be able to be in this kind of beautiful positive bubble of self-expression.
Absolutely. And I did get to watch bits and pieces of the mini documentary, Letia, specifically around Ethan, because that was a quite a significant moment, how he kept talking about, coming from the islands and the switch up of a different community in New Zealand, being more accepting of even his, choice of creativity through dance. Do you feel like a lot of Pasifika kids in New Zealand don't really have that sense of community sometimes?
I don't want to generalize. I think everyone's journey and relationship to community is different. I think what Ethan speaks to really beautifully is I think the expectations that are often put on Pacific men, that it's often about, the sort of very stereotypical ideas of masculinity, of sort of strength and going into sport and playing rugby, and that when young people, young men, young women, gender diverse folk have interests that are outside of sort of the norm or the tradition or the stereotype, that they can sort of be excluded or othered. I think that can be a struggle when people don't feel like, when young Pacific people don't feel like they're within their communities, that they can be themselves and express themselves how they want to. But what was really beautiful, I think, with, Ashley, Ethan and Boba, was that all their families are so supportive of their K-pop journeys and their interest in K-pop and their passion for K-pop. So I think it's hard to generalize, but I do think that what I really hope sort of drives home is that the importance of allowing Pacific youth to be themselves and to celebrate that and to support that and to honour that.
Yeah. Look, I have to ask though, are you a K-pop fan yourself, or have you become one since making this mini documentary?
Yeah, I've gotten into listening to a lot of the music because we were listening to it all the time when we were filming, and it really is so fun. And like, I even kind of learned, maybe just by osmosis, was like picking up some of the dances, and it is really cool. And I'd like to actually get into some of the Korean dramas. I like Korean films, so yeah, I know the K-dramas, a lot of my friends are really addicted to them, so I'd like to get into that as well. I mean, there's so much to it. There's just hundreds and thousands of yeah, pieces, yeah. And artists and things to explore.
Don't worry, you don't have to remind me. I feel like Korean dramas are on daily at my household. But how can people actually watch this mini documentary? Where should they go?
So it is available on the spinoff, .co.nz, which is a New Zealand news media website. It's available there and on the spinoff's YouTube page. So if you type in k-polly's doc, it'll come up. Hopefully on one of those two things.
Absolutely.
Oh, hey. It's on Instagram as well, the spin-off Instagram as well. You can watch it on there.
Beautiful. And yes, we will have that up online so people can be directed to that space to watch it. But Lydia, wonderful work. Always looking forward to something else that you'll be coming up with, but we appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you so much.
No worries. That is filmmaker Lydia Tuipurelevu behind the new mini documentary, K-Polly's.
For centuries, Pacific Islanders have been sharing stories across the region. Stories from the Pacific is a weekly program that honours that tradition, allowing you to hear in-depth personal stories from sportspeople to farmers, artists to teachers, activists to entrepreneurs, with one thing in common: their Pacific heritage and a unique and incredible story to tell. Stories from the Pacific, Wednesday mornings at 9 o'clock PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. It's time to take a look back at one of our main stories today. In Vanuatu, villagers living beside Erako Lagoon near Port Vila are planning to take the government to court for environmental neglect, led by Chief Ken Andrew.
We are thinking enough to blame the government into court because the hospital belongs to the government. And who can help us? There's nobody thinking that I will help you people.
Well, we'll be back at the same time, 6 a.m. PNG time tomorrow, but you can listen to our afternoon show at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned, because up next it is your news on ABC Radio Australia, and then coming up after that, it's Nisha Daily. But until then, I'm Aggie Tupou, and you've been tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.